Thanks, David, and thank you all. I'm delighted to be here, and can I thank Kerry for a stimulating overview of the challenges facing Sydney and the responses that the government's been making to those challenges. In listening to Kerry, I mean, I think the theme that comes through is here we are planning a critical resource in a period of great uncertainty. Now, there's great uncertainty about the climate. Kerry said it would be nice to have some paleo evidence taking us back a couple of thousand years in the Warragamba catchment. But that'll be interesting to see. But how reliable that is a guide to the future is also quite challenging. Because when you look at the global climate change that is now happening, the carbon dioxides are now 380 parts per million compared to a long term in the past of 280. The carbon dioxide is going up vertically. The consequence of that is the temperature change, which you are now mostly can agree you can see. We can't prove there's a connection with the drying and the rainfall shift, but it's plausible according to all the models, and it seems to me is what's happening. So I think one of the challenges for water planning is, do you plan over the last 100 years? Do you smooth out those wrinkles? Or do you, in fact, plan over the last 10 years because that's what you're living in? And that's one of the arguments and the challenges of water planning. I think there's also uncertainty about the rest of it. Will she keep having to cope with 55,000 extra people a year? Will that increase or decrease? Will it decrease when the price of water goes up by $160 extra? Probably not. But how are those people going to live? Are they going to live in apartments or houses with gardens and pools? How much water will they want per head? How much will they want for their open space and for their workplace? So there's a lot of uncertainty in all of the elements that we have to deal with in water planning. I guess Kerry's address raised three interesting issues for me. The first one is, have we reached the limits with demand management? Sydney's pretty proud that it's sort of handled almost an extra million people over the last 20 years without much increase in actual use of water. And during a drought, there's no doubt that our communities are pretty well behaved and do tighten their belts and use less water. The question is, are they getting exhausted with that sort of restrictions? And are they going to become less accommodating as the restrictions persist? We've always known that restrictions would be a part of the mix in dry periods. We didn't really expect that we'd have restrictions as severe and as long as we've been now experiencing them. Now, when we've had previous droughts, people have cut back their water use, but after the drought, as soon as they've seen it raining, the water use has bounced back after about a two-year period. Will we see that again? The water authorities are all saying, we hope not, and we're going to keep advertising and educating people, but that's been the history. We're also now starting to get calls for people to have unlimited use for their water for their gardens, for their pools. The argument is, if we can afford to pay, we should be able to have the water. Well, you can. Build a bloody tank and collect it yourself. It's quite costly, but you've got that option. We've had the Prime Minister come out and say that permanent restrictions are unacceptable in a city. Well, what are restrictions? Is it sensible to use good drinking water to hose down concrete, or are some of those simple basic restrictions just sensible use of water in a dry country? I think you've got to look at the value of the garden industry, the horticultural industry, the lawn maintenance and all the rest of it. I haven't got the detailed figures, but I think WASA did a study a little while ago and suggested the economic value of that industry was about the same size as the rice industry. So are we going to treat that as an industry that needs to be protected? And I think also we've got to push ahead a bit further with the water efficiency. We've done quite well with dual flush toilets, where Australia has led the world, but there are still buildings that don't have them. And you go to hotels around this country, you'll quite commonly find hotels don't have those sorts of fittings. When you talk to the hotel industry, they say, well, we have a voluntary code. The voluntary code doesn't seem to be all that effective. Certainly some of the older stock perhaps need to be retrofitted. Then you think about the fact that, on average, we're all using about 220 litres of water a day in our homes. How realistic is that? How much do we really need? So my first question is, what are the limits to demand management? Where will that go? My second question is, this assumption of another 55,000 people a year coming into Sydney. Last century, we allowed subdividers to divide up land, and then they'd call on the water authorities to build pipelines or supply the water. I wonder whether we're not past that, and whether we shouldn't in fact be demanding evidence that the water is available before we allow the subdivision. If you don't do this, what you're really saying is the existing people who've got water in Sydney are going to share it with these extra people, and we might all just have a little bit less. Now, we've got a model for that in irrigation. If you wanted to start a new irrigation farm in an over-allocated catchment, you have to buy a water licence from an existing water licence holder. Can we take that basic principle from the National Water Initiative and apply it to subdivisions? Require developers to either acquire water from another user or to create more water through a recycling, desal or a stormwater harvesting. And I just feel that if we could get that driver into the subdivision marketplace, we could really start driving innovative water-sensitive urban design. At the moment, we're at the stage of sort of wringing our hands saying, wouldn't it be good to have better planned subdivisions with more water efficiency? Basics is a good start, but it's only a start. And I think we could drive a lot more innovation if we could get some price levers. I think there's another point that about pricing for externalities. It's a key principle that every time the Premiers and the Prime Minister line up to discuss water reform, which is quite regularly, they agree that the best practice pricing, which includes externalities, will be in practice. Just as regularly as them agreeing to that, they ignore it as soon as they get home and face the wrath of their voters who don't want to pay any more for their water. So we agreed in 1994 we'd build externalities into the costs, and we've been ignoring it ever since. We've agreed it again in the 2004 National Water Initiative. I am particularly interested in the externality of allowing you to have a subsidy from the environment by treating partially treated wastes into rivers and to the sea. It seems to me that if you are going to contaminate water, you have an obligation to treat that water back to the stage where it can be discharged without any harm, or it can be recycled. And if we could do that, we would change the economics that Kerry showed you of recycling quite dramatically. We would make recycling look very attractive because the actual costs of the treatment would be built in the first user of the water who's contaminated. Your recycling costs then become redistribution costs. So at the moment we're taking a free subsidy from the environment by tipping partially treated wastes into the waters. Now, the National Water Initiative is a blueprint for water reform that everyone's agreed to, but it's relatively silent on many of the issues facing scarcity in urban Australia. I guess even in 2004, there was a view that the urbans were doing pretty well, the real problem was in rural Australia, that's where the reform had to go. Since then, we've been having a race between about five of our capital cities to see who could run out of water first, and they're all going rather well. It's a bit early to say who's going to win. In fact, I could, but I won't. It might stimulate speculation in the share market. But it's pretty obvious who's going to win if you understand the sums. But I think there's a lot of principles in the National Water Initiative which are just as relevant to the urbans, and we perhaps need to apply them a bit more seriously. The underlying principles are measure and control all of the available resource you've got. And the second one is to allocate the consumptive pool efficiently between the competing users, and that's where we want to use a market. Now, when you talk about understanding the available resource, you've got to think about the whole water cycle, the rainfall, the catchment water. You've heard about all of that. Urban runoff, the stormwater from our streets, the wastewater stream, groundwater and the seawater. So all of those sources have got to be on the table and assessed fairly carefully. For each one of them, you've got to identify what are the sustainable levels of extraction and how much can you take from those waterways and still have a water body. We're probably taking too much from the surface water, and that's why environmental flows have to be put back into the rivers. We haven't got a clue what the sustainable levels of extraction from half of our groundwater resources in this country are. Many people seem to think groundwater is just a magic pudding, that when the surface water dries up, we'll just pop down some bores and off we go. Well, hello, it's the same water. It's just that there's about a 20-year time lag between the rainfall getting down into the groundwater. When we operate below those sustainable levels of extraction of surface and groundwater, we're really just mining the resource, and something's going to collapse, perhaps without warning, causing us some pain. There's a challenge, technically, in assessing the sustainable levels, especially in terms of the climate shift that we're now experiencing. But the idea of measuring all your sources of water, treating the whole water cycle, all of those principles in the National Water Initiative are spot on and can be used to address the challenge of urbans. But do we have controls in this town about groundwater? Do we know what licences there are for bores into some of the aquifers around Sydney? We do know that at least half the bores are unlicensed, and we don't even know how much is being taken out. So we do need to control all those sources of water, treat it as a single lump of water, and we're not yet doing that. So the challenge to me for urban Australia, start thinking whole water cycle. Consider all sources of water, make the best use you can from wherever it is after you've done the sort of analysis that Kerry showed you. Technical analysis, can you make it work? Economic analysis, is it sensible? I think you've got to look at the greenhouse gas implications of everything we do, because the recycling and the desal and the pumping large distances all are putting more greenhouse gases into the air. They appear to be causing the problem, and yet our solution to it is to accelerate the problem. Sounds like heading towards a cliff in a car and you put your foot in the accelerator as a device to sort out the problem. So we have ways forward in all of this. We just need to have serious and rigorous planning, and Kerry's given you an example of many of the strategies that are being used in the Sydney region. Thanks very much.